Today is the real opening night. I always like to call it that when we have our first real day of NBA games. A ton of games today. We tried to watch absolutely as much as we could in that 6 hour window or so and two TVs. So we got a lot coming today. We got to talk about Orlando and Miami and Dallas and Indiana. Those were the early games. So any game that starts at four, you're always going to get at least some of that from us probably. And then Philly and OKC was really the main event of the day. Joel Embiid's professional debut. Get a little bit of Minnesota Memphis. Didn't see all that game, but enough. Got to break down Anthony Davis's 50-point game. I didn't see that game live, but we at least got a chance to go through all of his shooting possessions and talk about how he looked and what this might mean for his season. And then Lakers-Houston, we watched that one, I think, in full, and looking forward to giving a full breakdown of that one. So, Danny, what was did you have a favorite game of the day? Should we start with?
Well, I think we should do it largely, at least in chronological order, but I think that the standout for me, mainly for emotional reasons, was OKC against Philly, just because it was a fun game. There were a few fun games, but also just seeing Embiid and seeing the Sixers look like a competitive team was wonderful after all the years of, you know, kind of having below NBA players on their squad.
Yeah, you actually came over to watch this one, and Bontemps came also, and you were so excited for it that you actually imperiled your Naked Labs weight loss challenge with me, fat loss challenge, I should say, with Shirley Temples in honor of Joel Embiid's debut.
Had to. But yeah.
But at least you did diet soda, though.
Yeah. As far as I know, no diet grenadine exists. So you have to make a sacrifice somewhere.
Yeah, I think that is the place to start for me, too. How did he look to you?
He looked good. I mean, with Embiid, you have to remember there's a fundamental difference between him and kind of the freak centers like Towns, who are kind of like, they're just big, but they're fast like a smaller guy. Embiid is a center. Like, he is a center. He just has some unusual pieces of his skill repertoire, both for his age and for his size. But in terms of like how he moves and all that, he's above average for a center, but he's not a freak in that way. He's a freak in other ways.
Yeah, I think that he really is just a real center. And I thought that him handling in transition, doing that type of stuff that we've seen Towns or Anthony Davis do, he's probably just not fast enough to really be doing that, even if he can have the skill level. He got ripped up once in transition, just trying to dribble up for not much reason. But I think he can just be an outstanding big man. And the three-pointer, I think, is something that he can hit on occasion. This is a Philly team that needs a lot of floor spacing, so he will be open there. He scored the first 2 points of his career on a beautiful switch and then back down to the foul line, left shoulder turnaround jump shot. That was fantastic after a little dream shake. I mean, in his moves, he's not like so quick with them, where he's just blowing by guys, Hakeem Olajuwon style. And he also has, to some extent, like a little bit of roboticism still in his moves, which you're going to expect when you spent 2 years going up against a chair. But he's got a lot of skills. He's got a lot of moves. And I think he's going to start putting it together piece by piece.
And he has good footwork, and that's something that always stood out even when he was in college, was that he had really good feet for a guy his size. And it's such a foundational piece for bigs, and a lot of them don't have it, and so that bodes well. And also, you talked about the idea of being robotic. He did better in space at moments, partially because of the way Steven Adams chose to defend him, than when he tried to go at Adams, but in a way that makes sense because Adams is a beast himself.
Yeah, when I talk about the roboticism, one of them was he tried to go with like a little bit of an up and under. Adams stonewalled him and he got kind of bumped into a tough fadeaway. And the next time down, he tried the same move with the same result. But actually, especially as Adams got into foul trouble, he was able to make some moves. He was screaming, apparently, "He can't guard me," at one point as well. Really a delightful player. But, he had some up and unders. He was able to hit a three, which of course brought down the house. I mean, the crowd was just so happy, including maybe one of like the greatest crowd chants ever in NBA history.
Well, yeah, I mean, chanting "trust the process," as I think that was at the same time as he yelled, "He can't guard me." And it's just like, that's kind of peak what the Sixers fan, like the "trust the process" fans have been looking for over the last couple of years. And to see it, you know, it's not all the way to fruition. It's not even close to all the way to fruition. A note I made during the game is that, well, of course, there are things we don't know. The Sixers are probably going to have about $50 million in space. So if they can show anything this season and they could get something with that more than just like throwing it like the Lakers Lakers did, it could be huge for them because they have so many young assets and they should get at least one, maybe two more.
Yeah, they should. And there's also a great tweet that Daryl Morey retweeted, Sam Hinkie's former boss, which basically said, Hinkie died for your sins, which I thought was just really funny. And again, we've said this before, I think even if Sam had some struggles with some of the emotional aspects, I thought he overall did an excellent job. And a lot of the stuff that was just political, why he got replaced, this idea of, oh, we can't have this kind of tanking, which, I mean, are they really going to be that much better even this year with all these guys? And so with that being the case, he did the right thing to start the franchise. Nick Stauskas, amazingly, this had to have been the best game of his career. 13 points on 7 shooting possessions. He got to the rim quite a bit. He even blew by Roberson at one point. He abused Alex Abrines one time. Didn't hit his 3. He was 0 for 1 on 3s. It was just actually attacking the basket and confidence. I mean, I think confidence, as Dirk Bodner talked about on my show, is really just the big thing for him. And just getting started early, he actually played 23 minutes. I was surprised he was even in the rotation, but then I saw who some of the other guys were and it made more sense.
I believe it was before you and I started doing Dunked On, we watched footage of Stauskas at Michigan together. And I was impressed with his handle. And, you know, he did some nice things. He was more of an off guard there, just like he should be in the pros. And today was the closest to that I've seen in the NBA.
Yeah, I was saying he's probably going to get his rookie option declined. I would exercise his rookie option just based on this game, in part because rookie options are so incredibly cheap as well in general, and they're so favorable for the team. But yeah, if he puts together another couple of games, like, why not? You said they could have $50 million in space, but again, probably not really going to be a darling of free agents by any means. The thing that really, and we'll get to Oklahoma City in a minute, I think we don't know what they are, but we know who the players are, at least that are on that team. One of the things that was troublesome to me was the bench rotations. Henderson only played 25 minutes. I don't know whether he's just on a minutes limit or something, but when you're playing Jeremy Grant, who actually scored okay, but his jump shot is really off. Hollis Thompson was negative 10. I just saw no reason to do that. And Philly had a nice lead. And then the first quarter, they took out everyone who mattered, and their lineup was McConnell, Grant, Hollis Thompson, Nick Stauskas, and Jahlil Okafor, and they gave back most of that lead, and then it was pretty much neck and neck the rest of the way. So I did not really particularly like that lineup or rotation. Sarge, he played 27 minutes. He was only 2 out of 12, but I thought he was at least a steadying influence, someone who could do something. Putting that lineup out there, that was a last year's Sixers lineup. You just didn't have any kind of chance with those guys.
One other thing we have to mention before we get to the Sixers is Gerald Henderson absolutely baptizing Sabonis.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, in the first play of the game. So, yeah, and we got to talk about Rodriguez, too. He was really, I thought, just having a real point guard, an adult in the room on this team, I thought was huge. And he had 9 assists, just his alley-oop passing. He had some beautiful lead lob passes, including that one on the first play of the game where Henderson basically just sat on Sabonis's head for an alley-oop that was just perfectly on target.
Yeah, and it ties in with something Seth Partnow and I talked about a year ago on Real Jam Radio, which was that if Hinkie, it might have been less time than that ago, if Hinkie had just signed like Jeremy Lin and given him, let's say, $10 million last year.
Yeah, and you're not, we've all said that, I think.
Yeah, I think we've all said that. It's like, you know, like that would have been enough, and we saw that with Rodriguez, the ability to hit open guys, it opens up so much with their game because you can make a cut, you can make a move, and they're going to find you.
Yeah, and even Covington only played 32 minutes. Yeah, I get it. If you had Simmons or something, you have guys who are really important, but having him play 32 minutes and he wasn't in foul trouble or anything either, he only had 1 foul, and then, you know, take 6 of his minutes or you know, at least play him 36 minutes, like, he's probably still their best player, I think.
Especially when you have a chance to win, like, you know, there are going to be games where you can play him 25 because you're getting beat by 20, but when you have a chance to win your home opener, why not push it a little harder?
Rashawn Holmes also had a nice run in his 12 minutes. He had 3 blocks. He is just a major problem for guys at the rim. They was really scaring Oklahoma City as well. You know, they're never going to defensive rebound that well when he's in there, but still, I think Holmes is someone who And then getting up for alley-oops too in the pick and roll game, I still think he's like someone who can really help a team, because you would think once they're all healthy, he's not really going to play at all. And then Jahlil Okafor did get up 10 shots in his 16 minutes. He was on a minutes limit in addition to Embiid, who played 22 minutes because he was coming off that knee injury, didn't have much of a camp. And Okafor, it was mostly just kind of the same pull-up jump shots, didn't really do any power moves. He did actually have a couple of flashes to me defensively. Like, I continue to think, because do you remember that study? I forget who did it. It might've been like Jerry Engelman or KP on, like, here, I think it was KP actually, who, these are all the players who had like as bad a defensive RPMs as big men as Okafor did, and they all were terrible and turned out horribly. You remember that study?
I do.
Yeah. And I feel like Okafor, compared to like the Enes Kanters and David Lees of the world, actually has more physical tools with that 7'5 wingspan and pretty decent feet. And, you know, at least he's got enough of a body that he's not going to get killed in the post. And so I don't think he's ever going to be great. His help instincts aren't great, but he does have the tools to at least affect things a little bit when he's there in a way that some of the other players on that list don't. So I don't know that he will get there, but I think it's possible, perhaps more than some of the other horrendous defensive centers that we've seen in history.
Yeah, there's a reason to like the Embiid, Okafor, Holmes center rotation. You know, the idea that while it's far from perfect, you know, there are better players in the league, but the idea that they all bring something different. Okafor can do really well against most second unit centers, and they won't be able to exploit his defensive lapses as much. You know, Embiid is, you know, we'll see as he grows into it, and Holmes being the guy who, when they get in foul trouble or they're looking for something different, the problem with that is they have Nerlens as well, and so that does lead to the kind of movement there. And something I've said for a while now and stand by is that the biggest determination in terms of what you do with their bigs is really Embiid, even though you're not going to trade him, because if Embiid is good, then you can think about it as Okafor being in more of his natural role, whereas if you need somebody to play all of those minutes, then maybe you keep both of them.
Do you have anything to say just about the end of this game and kind of how it went down?
Well, I mean, it kind of bogged down a little bit for Philly, but Russell Westbrook made one hell of a play towards the end.
Yeah, that was the key play where Philly was going for the tie. Westbrook hit a really tough play off of a switch where he just was going to his right, which he usually likes to go to his left a little bit more, kind of fading away, kicking his leg out for balance. And he was just by far the best player on the court, obviously. 32 points, got to the foul line 11 times, very, very efficient. 9 assists, 12 rebounds. Just nobody else in this game even remotely can approximate the talent and level of skill and even just understanding of how to be a superstar that, you know, in a game like this, when there are other stars, Russ can get a little bit out of control, but he absolutely should try and take over in a game like this because he's just by far the best player on the floor. And then Enes Kanter also had a really nice game, plus 11, 17 points in 24 minutes. And they closed both halves with Kanter and Adams together. And with the Sixers going pretty big as well, Saric not shooting well from downtown, that was able to be really effective for Oklahoma City. And like always for Philly, they ended up just having a terrible net rating in the last 5 minutes of a close game.
Yeah, it's a part of their story, at least at present. We'll see if that can change when you know, these guys get a little bit more together, especially, you know, they are missing three key rotation players, missing two starters. And then, you know, just that is a potential mitigating factor here, but not a complete one. And one of the frustrations for me that was borne out kind of in the Spurs series and then, you know, a little bit tonight is make Enes Kanter defend in space. And when you kind of make him stand in a spot and put his arms up, he's okay. You know, he's not great at it, but he's not bad. And then when you back him down, he's kind of stout in that way. There's a parallel there with David Lee. David Lee does badly in space as well. And so that doesn't always mean, oh, you know, like have his guy be the ball handler, but just bring Kanter out and then he's not going to be able to help. You know, you're going to figure something out. And the Sixers didn't do that. But over the course of the season, opponents will probably go to that more. And that also ties in was something that was a little bit surprising to me, which was I thought Steven Adams in this game looked better than I expected offensively and worse than I expected defensively.
Yeah, I think part of that was the result of being in foul trouble, but he did not do a good job in Embiid. Embiid had a lot of success turning and facing, and then Adams just didn't eat up the space. Adams has pretty quick feet. I think he's got just as much strength as Embiid does. I think you got to close down that airspace. I mean, all Embiid has been doing is shooting standstill jumpers the last couple of years and make him put it on the floor a allow your help defense to get involved as well, because Embiid is not going to make a pass. He made one pass actually from the baseline out to the top for a three that missed. That was a little encouraging, but overall he's going to have tunnel vision, and so is Okafor. And I agree with you with what you said about putting him in space. I think, you know, this is still a developmental year for Philly. When Embiid is on the floor, they're going to go through him. Okafor posted up a billion times as well. And so they really did that instead of attacking Cantor and pick and roll defense. He's actually not so bad as a post-up guy. The last play of the game I thought was somewhat indicative as well. Brett Brown set it up for basically a dribble handoff, pick and roll for Gerald Henderson, not necessarily Rodriguez. It was also not involving Cantor, who was on the floor for some reason, as I recall, at the end. And it involved Embiid, but Embiid doesn't really set a solid screen. He's rolling for his own offense at this point. And what that means is before his guy even gets there, he slips the screen thinking that he's going to be open because his guy is going to help out. And a lot, you know, that'll work sometimes. You have to switch it up. But generally, the point of a pick and roll is to pick off the man who's guarding the ball handler and force that help. And you can always go ahead and roll later. The reason the roll works is because you're forcing help to begin with. Unless you know the other team is just trapping your point guard, I don't really see the point of rolling so hard early. And then Westbrook made a great play to come off of Rodriguez on the wing, and he messed up Henderson. Henderson had a tough shot, and that was pretty much it for Philly in this game. Any other observations before we move on?
I want to make a small kind of emphasis on something you just said, which is that it seems like big men at this level haven't fully embraced the idea that setting a good screen often creates an opportunity for them. This is true of pick and pop bigs as well. They are like, oh, I'll just jump out and that'll work. But if you set a screen, then they have to help over, and it kind of pulls both guys in the same direction and creates even more space. And you see a lot of, like, Porzingis does this, and Embiid did it in this game. And so really getting into the idea of setting good screens. Tim Duncan, I think, is a guy who's a good example of getting more space for himself by setting good screens.
Victor Oladipo, we should talk about. He really struggled, was only 2 out of 8 at the rim and 0 of 5 on threes. And those are the two things that he's struggled with when he has struggled in his career. He just went into a lot of traffic. Embiid really caused him problems at the rim. Oklahoma City just in general didn't have much in terms of spacing. And then Domantas Sabonis is starting. He obviously is not the best player. This is going to be one of those ceremonial things where he probably never comes back in most of the time. But hey, you know, we drafted him high. We want to make him look good, whatever. And he did hit a three, look good there. But the one time he tried to drive, you know, it's just left every time. And in college, he was able to just kind of lower his shoulder and go through guys and still go up with that left hand. He's not going to be able to do that in the NBA. He just got violently blocked by Robert Covington when he went to do that. So he's going to have to diversify his game more offensively. All right, we'll get to the rest in the second. But first, let's talk a little Indochino. So did you get your suit, by the way?
I have not gotten it yet, but I did go in for the fitting, and that was it was a great experience to really go through that process and see their service firsthand.
Yeah, if you happen to live in a city where there's an Indochino outlet, you can actually go in and have them measure you themselves. You can get any premium suit there for just $389 and free shipping. I actually wore one of my Indochino suits last night, and it was this three-piece that got plenty of compliments on, even like security guards that I had like never had a chance to talk to before, like, hey, nice suit, man. It was quite flattering. So Indochino, just their stuff is going to fit better, especially for someone like me. I'm 6'6", so it's hard for me to find anything off the rack. If you don't have one in your area, they do ship internationally, and all you got to do is just do your measurements yourself. There is a tutorial on their website, so it's very easy for you to do. There's nothing like a made-to-measure premium suit, and you can get 50% off the regular price at Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE to get any premium suit for just $389. That CAPSPACE code gives you the discount, also lets you know that you came from us. That's Indochino.com, promo code CAPSPACE. Where should we go next?
Anthony Davis and the Nuggets Pelicans game.
Yeah, and apologies that I will not be talking that much about Denver here, because we obviously had a bunch of other games to watch. Haven't had time to watch this game in full yet, although I would like to see it. And Denver, we're going to see a lot more too on the West Coast. That's part of my thinking, is these West Coast teams, you always get a chance to see them late, whereas the East Coast teams, when you get a chance to watch him, you probably want to take it. But in any event, AD was just unbelievable. I had fretted earlier in the season, in the preseason. Justin Ferrier was on my show. We talked about it, that he had not looked good finishing. He looked a little bit slow. Apparently spraining his ankle made him awesome again, because he had 33 points in the last game of the preseason. And then he dropped this 50 on the Nuggets. The Nuggets were uniquely poorly situated to handle him. They don't have anybody. They tried every single person they had. First, they started that Nurkic-Jokic combo. Jokic was on him. AD just blew past him all the time. Jokic was not able to handle him in pick and roll. It was a great job of setting him up by Tim Frazier as well before he fouled out. So AD was getting pick and pop jumpers. Didn't even hit a three in this one, actually. Pick and pop jumpers coming down the lane. His timing, especially when the pick and roll will get iced, he's able to just time it perfectly, find the opening. Frazier was able to dime him up. So he was able to get the ball on the move going right down the lane. He was able to shoot his jump shot, and then they started going to him in the post, and he was able to blow by Jokic. They put Wilson Chandler on him. He was able to shoot turnarounds over Chandler, or even use his long strides to blow past him. Nurkic got beat a couple of times as well. Gallinari can't handle him. They went with Fareed finally, as the Pelicans made a furious comeback, and Fareed obviously is not the greatest pick and roll defender, but may have been the best option that they had. So he basically, by playing at center, took that Nurkic and Jokic lineup off the court, and that was too bad, because Nurkic and Jokic, especially Nurkic, was awesome in this game. So I just thought AD looked great. Really bodes well. I mean, maybe not for the Pelicans as a team, but at least for him. And maybe when Jrue Holiday comes back, they'll have Frazier coming off the bench. He looked good, as I said, and they can do better. They also the bit players couldn't do anything. Like Solomon Hill only played 27 minutes, and I think it was 1 out of 7. Couldn't hit a three. They really didn't shoot that well from three, other than or at least Davis hit his mid-rangers, but they did not shoot that well other than that.
So watching all of Davis's shot attempts, a couple of things stood out beyond what you said, which is all legitimate, as well as reminder that he is such a great transition player. A lot of that is also that he's more athletic than the other big men. So when
we didn't even talk about the steals. He had seven steals.
Like when you can beat your counterpart down the floor, and you're adept at finishing and everything else, like you can get a lot of those opportunities. And he had a great game. It did feel like there were certain times where he just kind of settled, but at the same time, when you're the alpha and the omega of your offense and you're not really a primary ball handler, that sort of thing does happen. We've seen it at various moments with kind of guys of, maybe not guys of his ilk, but guys who, you know, shoot a lot of shots but aren't really creators. And I'd love to see him create a little bit more. But something else I wanted to note, you kind of alluded to Nurkic. I watched all of Nurkic's attempts too, and that actually in some ways illustrated more about the Pelicans than it did about the Nuggets, because they were all at the rim, every single one. And he was 9 of 13. One of his four misses, he immediately caught and put back up. So it was more like three. And most of them were a situation where the help defender just didn't get there in time. And so the Pelicans split it about 50-50 in terms of when they played a true center and when they didn't. When you play a true center, that guy either has to get over there or somebody else does. And Nurkic doesn't usually have the best touch around the rim, but he actually also did a better job than usual of making those touches count and getting the ball in the basket.
Yeah, the Pels actually did better with traditional centers on the floor. Ashik actually was positive. Ajinsa was only -4, and then Terrence Jones was -14. And he was really one of the big culprits. And then Hield also was -12. Hield was 2 out of 8, and Jamal Murray was 0 for 2. They both played about 15 minutes. And Mike Malone actually had a quote earlier, which I happen to agree with, was not borne out by this game, that it wasn't even close between Murray and Hield. Murray obviously went one pick after Hield, and just because of the ages, I feel pretty similarly about that, because Murray is about 3 years younger than Hield is. Couple of other notes on this game. Will Barton, early season form, 22 points on 15 shooting possessions. And then Davis, you remember the knock on him was that he couldn't create his own shot a couple of years ago. And still, a lot of what he did was in pick and roll, but he got in the post plenty, and he was a matchup nightmare. And not that we'll see what happens when he's guarded by like Draymond Green or something, or a really good defensive power forward. But I mean, they tried 5 guys on him and couldn't stop him one-on-one. So it seems like that weakness now is no longer something that you can attack. And the steals that he had, I mean, that's the 7 steals. These weren't just like, hey, I'm going to knock the ball away from you with my long arms. They were I'm going to crash into the paint. You're going to try and throw a cross court pass, and I'm going to sprint out there and get it. It's trapping guys at half court, sort of lazing back in transition, lulling the defense to sleep, and then cutting back in front of an outlet pass to a guard. Now, I didn't watch the game to see how many times he gambled and didn't get it, and he also had four blocks too. But really just a remarkable performance. Glad to see that he's back, that hopefully this injury is not going to be an issue. He did play 41 minutes. Not so good. And Gentry, with some of the pressure in the organization there, never having made really a priority of health in that organization, despite the fact that they have had such a bad health record. 41 minutes in the opener for AD is not really that positive of a sign, especially when you consider that, yeah, they made a comeback, but they were down pretty significantly for most of this game.
One other note I had on this one is that the Denver committed 16 live ball turnovers, and the Pelicans only had 15 fast break points.
That's not pretty good.
No, it isn't.
Usually teams will score about 1.20 points per possession after a steal, so that's not good at all.
Yeah, and that doesn't even account for their other 8 turnovers that were dead ball turnovers. So I mean that, or just running outside of that. So yeah, especially when Anthony Davis, as I said earlier, is a great transition scorer, they are missing Drew in that sort of a circumstance, but you should be able to at least just have guys run down the floor and hit him.
Let's turn now to Dallas and Indiana. Not a game that I actually expected I was going to watch a lot of, and then we got sucked in because it was pretty close late. I think the number one story out of this one was Miles Turner. Turner was unbelievable in this one. He had 30 points on 21 shooting possessions, 16 rebounds, 6 on the offensive end, and 4 blocks. His shot blocking, and 2 steals too, by the way. His shot blocking is just ridiculous. Like, he gets over there so quickly, and he just doesn't need to load up when he jumps. Like, he's just in the air. Most guys, if they're moving their feet, they have to really gather themselves to jump, whereas he can just be sliding, and then all of a sudden he's in the air and he just gets guys. It's really a remarkable skill that he has. And then most of what he was able to get to the rim a little bit, as we noted with the offensive rebounds, but a lot of what he did was just awesome shooting on mid-rangers.
Yeah, I mean, if you can pick and pop, especially against, you know, as a true center, which he is now that Jan Mahinmi is out, like, it's a huge tactical advantage because the other team has to make a choice that they don't want to make. And so you can pull a guy out, you can do lots of different things with that. And Turner, not only is he making that shot, but he's very comfortable taking it. There isn't much hesitation. And that makes it even harder because you have to make that decision immediately. It's not like a guy who you get that extra beat because either he, you know, has to load up a shot or he might think about it for a second. And yeah, he was really impressive in that way. And Andrew Bogut is good at many things. Guarding a pick and pop big is not exactly one of them.
No, it's not. He got lit up by Turner. And then, you know, Dirk obviously was guarding him some down the stretch too. That's not going to work either. And so he was able to just get any long twos that he wanted, and he hit him really well in this game. And he also was able to beast Bogut on the offensive glass. And Bogut was negative 19 in his 20 minutes, did not even come close to sniffing the floor in the fourth quarter. As first they went with Dirk at center, and they had Harrison Barnes at the four, and then they actually put in Dwight Powell for a brief spell at the beginning of the overtime. For Indiana, any other thoughts on how they looked?
This whole game was just really sloppy. I mean, there were a lot of just weird turnovers in it.
Neither of these teams are much good on defense, I don't think. Maybe the Pacers are going to get there, and maybe Dallas is a good offense, but I thought the Pacers' defense was not very good on Dallas. They gave up 48 three-point attempts, which is not what you want.
Yeah, and I mean, and there were certain times where it was more defensible, but I mean, I even got mad. I know that you weren't as vehement about it as I was, that they didn't foul when they were up 3 and Deron Williams was not in a shoot.
Oh, yeah, here, can we, let's just go through that whole sequence, right? Because
sure.
Indiana had what seemed like a pretty safe lead, and then Indiana takes Turner out for a defensive possession, and they were up by 4. Barea missed a 3. Barnes was able to get the offensive rebound. I guess they didn't want Turner in because they felt like they couldn't guard Dirk Nowitzki in pick and pop, but they put in Rodney Stuckey and left Monte Ellis in for that possession. So they give up a jumper to Dirk. It's a 2-point game. At that point, there were 28 seconds left, and Dallas had no timeouts remaining. The Pacers took a timeout to get some subs in, and it looked like Dallas was just going to run the clock down, which I didn't agree with, because 4.5 differential with no timeouts remaining, you're really going to be hard-pressed to come down and score. But what ended up happening was Ellis got pressured up. He decided he was going to go down the lane with like 20 seconds left, got stripped on a great play by Dirk, and it was only unlucky knocking the ball off of someone's foot that Deron Williams lost the ball back to Indiana, and then they had to foul. Teague hit one out of two, and then again, they still had Monte Ellis in the game for this possession. Their plan was they're going to switch everything, and so they ran a couple of pick and pops. They got Ellis onto Dirk, then they were going to switch it. They blew that. Both guys went with the ball handler, who I think was Barea, and then Dirk was wide open. The wing had to come off of Harrison Barnes to guard Dirk, and then Barnes just got a wide open three, which of course he hit to tie it. Barnes actually has a decent record on those late game shots. And I think he ended up with 14 points. So that's how they got into overtime. And then the play that really won it for the Pacers in overtime was they were up one with about a minute left. And Paul George, who had a wonderful game himself offensively, ran a pick and pop with Turner from the right wing. Turner just stayed there way on the right wing. George sucks in the defense, goes all the way under the rim to the opposite block, and then throws a hook pass back over his head to Turner about 30 feet. Turner hit the three, and that was the end of the game.
Yeah, it was an amazing read. I mean, it wasn't as much, I guess, knowing that he was there because Turner didn't really move, but just to be able to make that pass considering the tall guys around him, I was very impressed that George was able to get that there and to get it there in enough time that the help couldn't arrive on Turner in time.
I wrote my Pacers profile a few days ago. They came out on Insider Today. And one of the things I said about Turner was when he gets a switch, he doesn't play that physically. And he did only shoot 5 free throws in this game, which is surprising given that he took 19 shots. But nonetheless, I said, hey, he's got to back down and be more physical on a switch. But in this game, at least, he was very successful just shooting over guys. He has this high release. He doesn't, it's all wrist at this point. He doesn't really need to bend his knees. And he's making that shot. So, obviously, you're only going to be so efficient at mid-rangers. He's not going to be as efficient as he was in this one, but he was just very, very successful. And we don't want to jump to conclusions too hard after one game, but if he at least looks like he can be pretty decent on offense and space the floor even from long two range, that's going to open things up a lot for some of these other players that Indiana has that need the ball in their hands.
Is there anything else in this game, or I want to throw a stat out from a game that we didn't watch?
Oh yeah, let's hear it.
So we didn't focus on Hornets Bucks. Apologies to fans of those two teams. But Jordan Tresky tweeted that when Giannis was on the floor, the Bucks scored 103.9 points per 100 possessions. And when Giannis was off the floor, they scored 68.9 per 100.
Yeah, and the Bucks just, we talked about this. Snell is still out with an ankle injury. He wasn't able to play yet. And Rashad Vaughn and Jason Terry and... got distracted here. The kitten just jumped on me. Who's that third guy who's just like not really good off the Bucks bench that I'm forgetting?
Beasley?
Yes, thank you. I think that might have been it. So yeah, those guys had to play like 55 minutes combined, and Vaughn was particularly bad. I think he was like negative 13 in 8 minutes or something. That's just what happens with him. All right, what should we turn to next here?
Let's go to the other early game, Orlando Miami, because that was our primary for most of the early session. I mean, to me, the largest takeaway from this, and it's a kind of a thematic parallel from the Bucks game we didn't watch, which is when you have a guy who is a talented basketball player and can't shoot, putting the ball in his hands can open things up. And in this game, Justice Winslow did a much better job with the ball in his hands than I remembered in last season or in his time at Duke. And he found cutters well. He did a really nice job. And you have to keep a man on him when he has the ball in his hands.
Yeah, he ran some pick and roll. He's always actually, I shouldn't say always, because back when I first saw him, he was a very defensive dribbler, even in transition. But last year, and then now this year as well, he looks much better in transition, doing Euro steps, getting all the way to the rim. And he was 7 of 9 right at the rim. And then I think 0 of 6 on jump shots away from there, 0 of 1 on threes. But
that three was really bad.
The Magic's defense, I thought, was really lacking in this one. Serge Ibaka was not giving them what he was brought in to do. There are a bunch of times when guys just drove right down Main Street. He was on the block and just never rotated over, didn't even jump. And that was a little concerning. Biombo didn't play because he's serving that suspension from the playoffs. But I think they did miss him. Vucevic doesn't provide that much at the rim either. And Miami, this was at least one data point that, hey, they're going to be really athletic. They're going to try. They're going to defend. Yeah, they shot 4 out of 16 on threes, and some teams can be able to exploit that. But they got on the offensive glass for 16 rebounds, and they just really stymied what the Magic were trying to do offensively. And I think a lot of teams might might end up being able to stymie what the Magic are trying to do offensively, though.
Yeah, especially when Jeff Green just decides to call his own number because, hey, he's open. So, I mean, it was also kind of an unusual game considering how early we are that both teams played nine or shorter rotation. Orlando only had eight guys come in the game. Miami had nine. And some of that is due to injuries for Miami's end. Josh Richardson would, of course, be a larger part of their picture, but he didn't play tonight. And, you know, sometimes you see teams fiddle around like the Sixers did and try out different guys, but both these teams kind of stuck with what they knew and what they were comfortable with.
Yeah, Rodney Magruder actually played off the bench. He had his debut, another just athletic try-hard guy for the Heat. Willie Reed was 5 out of 6 from the field. Whiteside, of course, did well, although he couldn't hit his free throws, but he still had 18 and 14 and 4 blocks. Was really a problem for the Magic at the rim. And just I thought that the Aaron Gordon experiment as a ball handler did not go particularly well. He was negative 11 and he was being guarded by Deion Waiters a large part of the time, who started and thought played pretty well in the floor game, although his shooting wasn't that good. Gordon really could barely dribble when he was being pressured up by Waiters. And then there were a couple of times when they'd switch and I mean, I was worried. One of the reasons I was worried about his ability to run pick and roll is because you can just switch or go under on him. And he didn't look very comfortable with, I think, the one jump shot I saw him take off the dribble when the defense was just laying off him. He did hit 2 out of 2 on threes, but overall the Magic 6 out of 17, nowhere near enough attempts. And it was just, I think, a disheartening start for the Magic against a team that I think they expect themselves to be better than at home. The Heat, by the way, had 74 points in the paint to the Magic's 36.
And Whiteside was a big part of that he just, at certain moments in this game, he just could not be denied. And that is something that the Heat are going to need if they're going to be competitive, because they don't have a lot of those kind of guys that you have to game plan for. And if Whiteside can do that, it's a big help. But while
I got one more stat here on Whiteside too, who, by the way, they still shouldn't be trying to post him up. I think they're doing that just to keep him happy. He's not good at that. So the Magic were 9 out of 28 in the restricted area.
Whew.
And a further 9 out of 23 in the paint non-restricted area. So that's 18 out of 51 in the paint. And really, the only thing that even made it remotely respectable was 10 out of 20 shooting from mid-range. And the fact that they put up 96 points, that was just a lot of garbage time at the end. Another disturbing thing, you mentioned Jeff Green. He played more than Hezonja, which was a little disturbing. Hezonja did not have a good game. DJ Augustin did not have a good game either. Miami's bench actually was very successful in this one.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure that, I mean, yeah, I mean, Fournier was all right. He wasn't that efficient. I just felt like the offense hummed a little bit better when he was out there. But Orlando, there are these kind of competing emotions with them for me. Like, I think that their defensive ceiling is pretty high. We didn't see it today, but they were also missing Biombo. But the concerns about their offense just not really having a thesis and not really working were definitely well-founded, at least today.
Another thing that I thought, and they used Ibaka as backup center as well, but if you look at, they kept a lot of unknown guys. CJ Watson didn't play at all. Who knows where his health is at his age? CJ Wilcox hasn't ever played rotation minutes before. And then Orinze Onuwaku and Damian Rudez were the other two players who were active in this one. And then Biombo was suspended. So they basically have 9 guys on this team. And if anyone gets hurt and they have to break into those bottom 4 names that I mentioned, that could be pretty ugly also.
And when you think about how many draft picks they had and how many guys they used to have on rookie scale deals to be at that point where you don't have even really like flyer guys is a little bit crazy.
2 other guys that deserved mention. Tyler Johnson really changed the game when he came in off the bench. The Heat actually started with Dragic, Waiters, Luke Babbitt, who spaced the floor at least to 10 attempts, didn't really hit that much, Winslow, and then Whiteside, and then they brought in Tyler Johnson and James Johnson. James Johnson somehow had 6 assists. He looks much more cut. I'd speculated that he would if he was in Miami, because they don't tolerate you being kind of chubby the way he was down the stretch in Toronto. And Tyler Johnson, he had a couple of nice dunks. I can't remember who it was that he just destroyed. I think it was Jeff Green, actually.
It was.
Came along from the baseline, got this sweet pass from Winslow in transition, and he'll just take off of 2 feet and dunk with two hands. I mean, you don't see like a little dude dunk like that. And so he really got Jeff Green. It was an outstanding performance from him. But again, we'll see what happens against a team that's going to defend better in the paint. Frank Vogel really has to be beside himself by the fact that this is not a team that can shoot or spaces you out, and yet you're still giving up all these points in the paint. They just were not tough enough in this game.
Are we ready to move to the funhouse mirror?
Wait, did we talk about Minnesota and Memphis? We should probably hit that.
Yeah, we should do that. Yeah, that's true. We can save the funhouse mirror for last.
Well, the Wolves started 16-1 in this one. Aaron Harrison and James Ennis both started. We thought maybe that those could be related, but then Memphis basically clawed back, and then the Wolves were in position to win it, and then they just had some bad luck and some mistakes. Wiggins missed two free throws when they were down one, and then a Karl Anthony Towns three from the left wing was halfway down and spun out, and then they were down by three at that point. Mike Conley came off a screen from Marc Gasol. Gorgui Dieng did not step up, and Conley had a nice easy mid-ranger to put him up five and end things for the Grizzlies.
If there are people, and I'd be interested to find out the match on this, if there are people who listen to this podcast who don't have League Pass, as long as the free trial exists, watch as much of Karl Anthony Towns as you can, because, well, you know, his overall line wasn't super impressive. I mean, by his lofty standards, he had a couple moments in this game that absolutely took our breath away.
Yeah, he had one where he caught the ball at the top of the key, pass faked the help guy out of position, and then just blew past, I think it was Zach Randolph, and dunked right down the lane. But Zach Randolph, I thought, actually played pretty well. He was instrumental in bringing the Grizz back. He had 19 points on 15 shooting possessions and 11 boards in only 24 minutes. So he looked really good. He made short work of some of those Wolves backup units that didn't have Wiggins or Levine or Towns or Rubio on the floor. And Tibbs usually likes to go with more of a backup unit than to do too much staggering. Going back to his Bulls days, that's what he liked to do. Anything else that popped out at you this game? We were kind of watching this more intermittently, so I don't have a ton more to say on it.
Wade Baldwin.
Aside from that. Yeah.
Wade Baldwin looked good. I mean, he wasn't really in kind of the traditional point guardy things, and I think that's part of what they wanted from him, but three steals, three blocks. He was actually two steals and two blocks from a 5x5 in this game, which is a little bit weird, and that is an overly fetishized thing, though it is pretty cool.
He came out of nowhere to just get somebody's shot in transition, like way up in the air, that I thought was pretty impressive. Yeah, he looked like he maybe could be competent. They had to play Deontay Davis because Drell Martin and Brandon Wright are both injured at the moment. Vince Carter actually played really well against Wiggins. Wiggins had been killing them, and then in the fourth quarter, Vince, I think, held in only 1 point. Vince actually played 28 minutes, amazingly enough, and was plus 10 as the Grizz had a nice little comeback in the fourth quarter. And I thought Marc Gasol actually didn't look slow. I thought he actually looked pretty quick. He had one play where Zach LaVine blew by him in a pick and roll, and Mark recovered to block his layup from behind. I mean, he's not going to be able to keep up with Karl Anthony Towns, but Towns didn't go crazy. Towns actually had 21 points on 20 shooting possessions. So it wasn't like he was absolutely destroying the Grizzlies. And then Ricky Rubio, a very Rubio line of 8 assists and 1 of 5 from the field, but only -1.
And an encouraging sign from Tibbs, just because I didn't expect it given his history, is that while Jang and Towns both played a lot, the only other traditional big man, so i.e. non-shooting big, that played any minutes was Aldridge, who they gave a big contract to this summer. He only played 9 minutes, so they went more in the kind of Bielitsa range and went in that route, which fits their talent in my opinion better, especially as Wiggins is still, you know, on his way to finding his jump shot, and Rubio as well is just not a good shooter.
Chris Dunn had some flashes. He was 3 of 3 inside of 8 feet and missed both of his jumpers like pretty wildly from what I recall, but at least looked like he was okay. But yeah, Tibbs played all of his starters at least 33 minutes and didn't play any bench guys more than 15 minutes. So it doesn't seem like he has a ton of confidence in his bench at this point. All right, now we're ready for the funhouse mirror, right?
That game was just ridiculous. I mean, we kind of circled it in our minds just because we knew it was going to be ridiculous, but the appalling lack of defense was awe-inspiring to a degree.
Yeah, although actually the Lakers did win it with defense at the end, but that first half was crazy. And we saw Pete Harden, I mean, I want to say he had all 17 of his assists by the end of the third quarter.
Yeah,
and really just was throwing some dimes in transition. It was a real big problem for the Lakers anytime he got a rebound and got downhill, and they were just having him bring the ball up every time. It looked great. His pick and roll passing, especially to Capella, was really outstanding. He was finding shooters on the weak side. Eric Gordon got going in a nice first half for him. And then the Lakers were able to come back too with some hot shooting from D'Angelo Russell. But I felt like they really were clearly getting outplayed, and it was 71-63 at halftime. And we were all talking about how it was going to, you know, who were they going to score more than a .128 or not, each team.
Yeah. And it had that moment. I mean, Harden had 9 assists in the first quarter, and a lot of those went to Clint Capella. I mean, Capella, I think he ended up with 16, and almost
he got
all
good
of them.
Hands.
He does.
He is, he, you know, the thought on him.
Nene did not.
Always. Yeah. Yeah. The thought on Capella is always so raw, and, but he actually is like a really good pick and roll finisher, and he can catch the ball and take a dribble and finish. Yeah, Nene did not play as well, but then Nene actually ended up closing the game over Capella, which I didn't necessarily agree with, and I don't know that Nene being in there lost them the game necessarily, but although Capella might have been a little bit better on the defensive glass late than Nene was, but it was disappointing for Capella. Had played well. I mean, he was 8-for-11 with 16 points, and then they just took him out for the last 5 minutes of the game.
Something else that Capella does well that is very important with his team, and it's not, this part isn't a criticism of Nene, is that he runs the floor aggressively. So he's going to get probably 6 points a game just by beating the other guy down and catching a pass because Harden can find him. Like, that's going to happen. And we saw little inklings of a long-term thing that we see with D'Antoni a lot, especially when he was coaching at Staples Center a few years ago, which is that, you know, guys like KJ McDaniels can do well in his system.
Yeah, KJ had 11 points, 5-of-5 from the field, and uniquely among the Rockets bench guys, actually was not negative plus minus. The big problem for Houston was that Harden was plus 15, and then they got outscored by 16 points when he was on the bench. So, and I think Houston actually hit a garbage bucket at the end too. So it was really very difficult for Houston, especially when your bench guys are Nene, who's okay, he's a decent backup center, and then you've got McDaniels, Corey Brewer, Sam Decker, Tyler Ennis. None of those guys can shoot, so you have no shooting and no playmaking off the bench. And I thought the other thing that was pretty huge, and I'm sorry, I misspoke, actually by the end of the game Harden was only plus 10, but still an issue, and Nene was minus 14 and Capella was plus 8. The Lakers actually defended by going to Julius Randle at center and switching everything. He switched on to Harden, stopped him a couple of times, and that the Rockets only had 2 points in the last 3 minutes, 30 seconds of the game. And that was a Nene bank shot from the left elbow. That was just a horrible shot that they lucked into.
And also, while the Lakers deserve a lot of credit for defending zealously, and Nick Young was a part of that, which was nice to see.
I can't believe Luke Walton is getting something out of him. Like, we thought he was just going to get waived. And that's, you know, we criticize Steve Kerr, kumbaya Kerr, but Luke Walton with that attitude, Nick Young is part of this team. Like, you know, the players were joking around Nick Young for defensive player of the year, and that's obviously ridiculous, but he's actually trying on defense. He wasn't taking terrible shots. Like, he was like, looked like a real basketball player out there.
And so one of the things that I noticed at the end, towards the end of the game, was that the Rockets just weren't running a lot of the stuff that was so successful earlier. And yeah, the Lakers tightened up their pick and roll coverages from
it's because they switched. That's why. That's why it ended up being an ISO, because they switched everything. And Mark Jackson on the broadcast actually said, oh, hey, I know what I would do. They're looking to switch. I would go with pick and roll at Randle and then put Randle on a Harden. But Randle's actually pretty good at switching, and he's not as good at help defense and executing. But if you just have him go one-on-one, he blocked one of Harden's layups. He contested a three-pointer nicely as well. And I mean, there's a reason that I noted this, that big men who are not, you know, real superstar players, you don't see them in the game a lot. And part of the reason for that, number one, is shooting. And I'm talking about in the game, at the end of the game, number one is shooting. And the other one is that switching really works. And James Harden, one of the best players, Julius Randle, not someone you think of as some defensive stalwart, he was able to stop him. And moreover, you know, he's not able to create for others. And he's not able to usually get to the foul line. But when you're really able to stay solid, you can help much more easily in those situations. So it was like, that strategy works. There's a reason why teams do it, even though for years and years it was like, oh, we can't do this. But now, especially with the new help defense rules, new in the last 15 years, it's a much more viable strategy.
Do you think just the overall fatigue, especially in a game like this, can help that as well, that you're going to have guys oftentimes that are with tired legs and you're just giving them less space to operate in?
Yeah, I think so. And it's also really, switching is easier on your defense.
Yeah.
Except for the guy who's guarding the ball. Everyone else can just kind of hang out and get a foot in the lane on occasion and just be ready to help. You don't have to really do anything. And I mean, teams are going to devise strategies to take advantage of switching more, but Houston doesn't have anybody who can hurt a switch except Harden himself. So it worked pretty well at what they've just been completely unable to stop anything in a conventional pick and roll style.
They actually do have another guy that can work in a switch. He just hasn't signed a contract yet. Demo can do some things in that just because he can post up smaller guys.
Couple of other points in this. I thought that Russell played well in the first half, although he was hitting some pretty difficult shots. At least they were threes, which helped. And Russell ended up with a decent line, 7 out of 16, 4 out of 10 on threes for 20 points. And 10 of his 16 shots being threes. How do you feel about that kind of a ratio from him?
It's going to depend a little bit on what the defense is giving him, but I'm broadly okay with that. I mean, there are a few guys in the league who, you know, if you kind of concede that above the break three, let's say on a pick and roll play like that, I feel comfortable with them taking the shot. Dame and Steph Curry are the most obvious, but I could see Russell getting there pretty quickly. I trust his jump shot, and he's also a good passer.
So, and he has looked good. He has looked comfortable. He's a good shooter, maybe even moving towards being a great shooter. He also will flash very nice passes at times, but he also like doesn't really ever get that many assists. You know, he had three assists tonight, you know, which is not, when you're taking that many shots and you have the ball in your hands that much, that's maybe not enough. And then the other thing is he doesn't really get to the foul line. And he doesn't really get to the rim either. I think he only took one shot at the rim and it was 2 of 3 from the foul line in this game. So if you're going to play like that, you better take a ton of threes and you better hit them, because otherwise you're not going to be efficient.
Something else I wanted to mention, and this goes into maybe a big picture thing with the Lakers, is that Jordan Clarkson to me always felt more like a third guard than a second guard. And the Lakers kind of just going after it, and while playing Nick Young in the starting lineup takes some guts, to put him in the role that is more like what he's going to eventually have to do is, I thought it worked really well. And he had a nice performance playing, you know, really, he did of course get serious minutes with the starters as well, but to be the offensive linchpin of that second unit, and he can do that as this team gets better with time.
It was a very egalitarian minutes distribution for Walton. Randall and Russell had 29 minutes. That was the highest of anyone on the team. Mozgov actually was good offensively in his time. And actually they were positive when he was on the floor too, but he had 12 points on 10 shots in his 22 minutes. I think, and Randall was 9 out of 11 from the field. Somehow didn't get to the line, even though he's shooting inside all the time. He had 6 assists as well and 18 points, and he played that good defense late. So probably, I would say, the best game that I can recall of his career. Not that there were a lot of bright spots before. Brendan Ingram chipped in. He was plus 10, 4 out of 6 from the field. And then Clarkson, as you mentioned, he had 25 points on only 12 shots, and he had a stretch where he scored 9 straight as the Rockets were blowing their lead with Harden out of the game. And then he had an offensive rebound of an air ball where he powered up inside, and then the key shot was a 3 late that he hit over Eric Gordon, where Eric Gordon was just very nonchalant, kind of on his heels, never really got into a stance, never ate up the airspace, and Clarkson just pulled up for a 3 maybe like a foot behind the line. Gordon had no chance of getting a contest, and really just not good defense at all, but still a tough shot off the dribble 3 by Clarkson that he made. And I do think maybe it makes more sense to bring him off the bench. You get Nick Young engaged that way. He was only 3 out of 12, but he did play some decent defense. We'll see whether he's, you know, it could just be that he still is so inefficient that eventually he can't play anymore. But at least you're getting something out of that position now, and Young closed it in that very switchy lineup late. And then Clarkson will provide you with at least some kind of an impetus somewhere to go on that bench unit, which is something that, you know, obviously Houston didn't have.
Also have to note that Dunked On favorite Tarik Black had 4 fouls in 11 minutes, just continuing his awesomeness.
A few other small notes on here. They put in Meta World Peace, who made the team over Anthony Brown, as we talked about yesterday. He picked up 3 fouls, all on James Harden, all stupid, silly fouls in the course of about 90 seconds, 2 of which were shooting fouls right at the end of the third quarter. That was a ridiculous sub. You remember those guys have some history too, because World Peace, that might have been back when he was Artest, really elbowed James Harden I want to say that was in 2012 and almost knocked him out.
When he was on the Thunder. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And then the Thunder actually beat the Lakers pretty badly that year eventually. But yeah, I think World Peace actually got suspended for like the first round of the first game of the playoffs as a result of that elbow. So those guys have some history. And Harden just thought that it was so ridiculous. You could just see him. Like, he didn't even stare him down after he got an and one on World Peace. He just sort of looked at him like it was not even worthy of a stare down. This whole, like, if you really want him around that badly, like make him a coach type of thing. I think this is a Lakers team. I guess they have enough young guys. They feel like that they can develop, but they still need another 3-and-D guy that they could be kind of looking for right now.
Yeah. And we should also mention that at least physically, Eric Gordon looked good in this game. He also put up a good stat line, but he just looked more like himself, more like the guy that we all liked when he was, when he was traded to New Orleans.
Yeah. I mean, he wasn't didn't have quite that level of explosion at the rim, but yeah, he was attacking hard in transition, getting to the basket, finishing when the Lakers just had nothing even approximating help defense whatsoever. So I thought he did play well, although again, he kind of tailed off late and was only 2 out of 8 on threes and had 0 assists, which you'd Harden, I think, had 17 of the Rockets' 29 assists in this one. Couple of other notes that I had. This is something to watch for with Houston. They run a really nice action. And this is something that I recall first seeing from Spain in the 2014 European Championships. 2014 World Cup, where they will set a pick and roll and then have someone else enter the action to actually screen the screener's man so he can't get over and help. And usually it's another big, but what Houston is doing now is actually having that be Eric Gordon. So Eric Gordon, if you think about it, is setting a screen at the free throw line as they're running the pick and roll with Harden on the guy defending the big who's trying to lay back and get there. So one of two things will happen. Harden was able to get right to the rim because Gordon's guy didn't help, or when Gordon's guy did help, then Gordon actually just flared back out to the top of the key and hit a three. So that was a really difficult action to stop if you're not switching, that you should watch for if you're watching Houston.
Yeah, it's a good call, and D'Antoni is always good for a few of those like thing wrinkles that you're going to see other teams steal and then everyone try to figure out how to stop.
Also, because a lot of even announcers don't seem to know this, there's a questionable potential 8-second violation. The 8-second violation is not triggered until the shot clock gets to 15, not 16, because that the shot clock hasn't actually gone below 16 seconds, so not more than 8 seconds have elapsed until the shot clock shows 15, because when it shows 15, that's actually 15.9999 seconds. That's when you know that it's happened. So 16, when it shows 16, that's from 16.9 down to 16.0. So it's not till you go to 15 that it actually the violation has occurred yet.
That is a good note. Anything else, or do you want to? I don't think we need to do much news, but there's at least one thing we should talk about.
Yeah, there is that extension that came out. We had talked about yesterday that there hadn't been that many extensions, maybe because the new CBA was chilling the market. Although maybe it's the case that teams have a better update than what's out there publicly. But the Schroeder contract, 4 years, $70 million. And there's also a non-guarantee on the end of that, right?
Yeah, it seems like there's like the last year is like partially guaranteed or something like that, because I think Mark Stein had out there after that it was like 462. So I'm guessing it's maybe like a half guarantee on that last year.
Yeah, and what do you think of that number for Schroeder?
It's funny because that's the exact same number Kent Bazemore just got, but Bazemore got it at a lower cap number than what we're expecting for next year, and did it as an unrestricted free agent when Schroeder's going to be restricted. So, I mean, Bazemore has proven substantially more as a member of the Hawks. So yeah, it's fine. I did the conversion thing that I've been doing using the 2015-16 season as a baseline. And so, yeah, it works out kind of to about like $10 million a year in last year's money. And that's fine. You know, there's nothing really wrong with that. And as is the case with all of these, where it looks like the years are a little bit low, is I am a little bit interested to see if there's any sort of player-friendly thing on the last year, but that potential non-guarantee makes it lean more towards it being just not really a player option, let's say.
Here's a way to think about this one, right? So, for example, Ty Lawson back in the day probably got about the same as this, right? That was 4 for 48. Drew Holiday was 4 for 44 back in the day. So that's probably kind of about the same as this in terms of what percentage of the cap it is. I don't think that he has shown as much as guys like that have. And I probably, especially because he's going to have a low cap hold, although that could change. There's been some reports that could change. We'll talk about about that more in a future episode, that it'll be a lot higher. But also just to have him in restricted free agency. Now, when you have a guy, we have seen this a little bit, that when you have a guy that you actually really want and he's not getting the offers, that that can really degenerate into an ugly stalemate along the Eric Bledsoe type of lines, along Tristan Thompson, along a Dennis Mattiunas. So this whole, oh, we'll let the market set it. But he just hasn't shown me enough yet. I think he has some potential, but he still has a lot of weaknesses in his game. He's got a lot to do in terms of consistency, defense, shooting, finishing at the rim. He has potential, to be sure, but I'm just not convinced 100% that this guy is my point guard of the future. I'm not convinced that he's really an average or above starting point guard and is going to get there. They are betting that he's going to get there, but to me, this seems like I don't see him ever getting to be a player who's like a $20 million a year player. I mean, like, what do you think is the absolute best case scenario for him as far as like where he would rank among the point guards in the league?
Let's say the realistic best case, so more in like the 75th to 80th percentile, maybe around like 20th, 15th to 20th.
But among starting point guards?
Yeah.
Like I think his ceiling is like the 15th best point guard in the league.
Yeah, so that's 15 to 20 is that, that's what I would say. So like—
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So, I phrased it inartfully, but that's what I was getting at. Yeah, I think he has more defensive potential than he has shown, and we'll see how the offense kind of turns around. But the other part of this, and it's interesting, our mutual friend Kevin Pelton wrote in his analysis of this about the idea that the Hawks retained the ability to have max cap space if Paul Millsap leaves, and that is certainly true. However, the difference between Schroeder's cap hold and what he's actually going to get a salary, and that switch happens, you know, basically as soon as it's agreed to and finalized, is that it really forces the Hawks to cut bait to do that. And if that margin of about $8 million, I think, is pretty close to like Kyle Korver's cap hold, for example. And we don't know exactly what he's going to be after this year. He looked worse. Korver looked worse in 2015-16 than he had prior. But, you know, like, you kind of want to keep a little bit more wiggle room than that. But you can also say that it's unlikely that Atlanta is going to be a real player for max level free agents if Millsap leaves. So maybe that's more of kind of an idealized amount rather than like an, oh, we need to keep this aside for someone specific.
To me, it's not so much about the lost flexibility, which is could be significant, but again, they may know something about what cap holds in the new agreement are going to be. There was a report from Bobby Marks, that you would assume getting it from some of his Yahoo cohorts, that rookie scale ending rookie scale contracts could have cap holds that go up a lot. So you can't do the Kawhi Leonard, Andre Drummond type of thing anymore with someone in restricted free agency. And so that could well mean that we are basically, there's not much opportunity cost in terms of cap space next year. It's more just, I don't know if this guy's the solution. I don't know if I want to commit to him yet. I feel like this is one of those cases where, all right, you know what? If he's really good, I'll just pay him $20 million a year in restricted free agency instead of 17. I'm willing to pay him an extra $3 million a year if I have to. And there's no guarantee that such offers would be forthcoming, but just if you had to do that, because I think then at least you know by that point that, yeah, I'm paying 20, but I'm paying 20 for a guy I feel very strongly is going to be good. They may feel that way about him. I'm not there yet, though. And this contract to me doesn't have enough of an upside. I don't see any way that he becomes like a $25 million player in restricted free agency next year. So there's not enough of an upside of 17 and a half to maybe 20 that I'm getting enough of a discount where that uncertainty that he might not actually be the solution at the position is taken care of.
Yeah, the lack of upside is the bigger concern for me, though the downside is there, because you just think that somebody, you know, maybe he will show enough that somebody will make him an offer, but you don't have to match if somebody makes something unreasonable. And, you know, it feels like his end game might be around this level. And if that's where your end game is, then you shouldn't make that agreement a year ahead of time when you don't know.
Couple other small notes here before we move on. Detroit Pistons, Cranes Detroit is reporting that an announcement that the Pistons are going to move to downtown to share the new hockey arena with the Red Wings could happen within days. That arena is supposed to actually open a year from now. So that would be cool if Detroit is back in downtown instead of way out in the boonies in Auburn Hills, where, you know, you've got acres of parking spaces around them and not much else. And then Shams Charania reporting that RJ Hunter in quote, serious discussions on a deal with the Bulls. He, in fact, cleared waivers, and that could be finalized in the next day. Your thoughts on RJ in Chicago?
It's all right. I don't think they have a really clear need for him in terms of the rotation, but that's not
You like the guy, right? You'd liked him in the draft. You want him to succeed. Do you think that Chicago is just not a good destination for him in terms of like his odds of succeeding and becoming a player?
I'd like to see him more in a system that has reliable shot creators and that has an investment in development.
I think they do have shot creators. They just don't have any shot makers.
We'll see. I mean, I would have liked to seen him, let's say, in Philly. Like, I think that could have been, you know, like a team that just doesn't really have much in terms of expectations. But it's fine. There are worse things in this world, and I understand how it happened with Chicago's specific constraints. Like, maybe I had floated the idea of Cleveland with him. Like, that would have been good. But it's fine. I have no opposition to it.
Well, to me, we'll have to see what the terms are on this deal. He is going to get paid for this year, not next year on that rookie scale deal. The Bulls did not have a mechanism by which they could have just claimed him off waivers. And the Bulls actually were the only team that had an open roster spot. Everybody else is at 15 right now, though obviously people could be waived to make that claim. There's no way he's going to be ready to help them this year, I think. So he's probably going to just play a lot with the Windy City Bulls. A little easier commute than from Boston to Maine, at least for him. And we'll see what happens with them next year, and things are pretty open for them next year in terms of some of the wings they might have if they were Wade or Rondo were to move on. Hunter is pretty redundant with Doug McDermott as kind of one trick pony shooters who don't really defend at all, so there is that concern. But you know, I mean, the Bulls have done reasonably well with player development. I think it's a fine place to end up for a team that we talk about as not having any shooting. Maybe he could become something there, and there isn't really another obvious destination that stands out to me.
Yeah, that's fair. And the idea of the 15 roster spots is certainly important because teams just made that decision. And so they chose the guys they have for a reason. And so making that super quickly is always a tough thing.
You know, Indiana, actually, I'd definitely rather have him than Rakeem Christmas.
Yeah.
They could use some shooting, although they don't know that they could. So
they have a lot of shoot. They have a lot of twos on their roster already. They just aren't the right ones.
All right. We done here?
Yes.
Plugs?
Just my stuff from yesterday. So did Locked On Warriors with Adam Lauritsen on that game, wrote two pieces for The Athletic. And then for people who haven't listened to it, I did a Southeast Division podcast with Adi Joseph and Mike Prada, which is still absolutely worth listening to.
For me, my insider profiles on the Wizards and Pacers came out today. Also did a few 5-on-5s with such luminaries as Kevin Pelton and David Thorpe and a few others, Jeremias Engelbaum, on the Wizards, the Wolves, the Bulls. A bunch of them have come out in the last few days to get ready for some of these teams that haven't played yet. So that's about all I got. Follow me on Twitter at NateDuncanNBA. I probably tweeted over 100 times. That might even be a conservative estimate during these games. I'm usually live tweeting. I'm going to actually go up to Sacramento tomorrow night for the opener of the Kings new stadium. And so I'll have some tweets from there. Maybe we'll talk about that on our next show. Tomorrow, stay tuned. We're going to do a mailbag on Reddit. We'll probably record that during the middle of the day on Thursday. But if you want to get in on that, I think there are a ton of comments and questions already, but maybe your question will be so good that you're going to get upvoted enough, and we'll try to do the ones that are both upvoted and appropriate on that tomorrow. So look forward to you hopefully listening again. We'll talk to you all next time.